I confessed the other day that my intercessory prayer life has slacked off, particularly from what it used to be. I still have good intentions. I carry with me not only the names of all the staff and the contacts, but the names of all the children and the year they were born. And I was just looking over that this morning before I came over here. Then I was given this cute little prayer reminder here by that Seifert thought up, pray for Taco. And search as I would, I couldn't find Taco's name on any of the lists anywhere that I have. Maybe Millie hasn't kept me up to date on all the births and navigators. I know that's a real job to keep up on all the marriages and the births and the navigators. We're quite a prolific outfit, to say the least. But Taco. Then I remember at boys' camp we had a burro called Taco. I don't know where Taco is. I don't think that's the one to pray for. But, of course, we know this means with a summer training program down in Mexico called Taco. And that's a great idea. Bob Seifert thought that up. For a little marker now. Pray for Taco. Okay. We'll do that. Turn with me to Psalm 27, if you would, please. Psalm 27, 4 and 5. One thing have I asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord, and to inquire in his temple. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will set me high upon a rock. In 1 Samuel 22, we have the record of where David was fleeing from Saul, went to the cave of Adullam, and there everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered themselves together to him, and he became a leader over them, captain over them. Here was a refugee in a cave, surrounded by a motley crew of people who are in distress, in debt, and discontented. And yet later on, when he became king, and united the kingdoms in Israel under him, the mighty man in his kingdom came from this band of men. He was a refugee. A few years ago, a close relative of mine and some of his friends cornered me at my parents' home to read their list of complaints about Christians and Christianity. Maybe I should say read me off with a list of complaints about. And one of them was that Christians are refugees from life. I said, guilty. You're right there. I am a refugee. I need a refuge. And the Bible has a lot to say about refuge. Hebrews 6, we are those who have fled for refuge. And here David, who is a mighty king and no sissy, says in verse 5, for he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He continued to be a refugee all his life. In fact, that's the first step to becoming a Christian, is to admit you have a need outside yourself. Of course, this whole Psalm 27 is a favorite, I'm sure, with a lot of us, if not all of us. So here he is, this Psalm of David, who spoke his heart honestly, sincerely, tells his the first thing on his priority list. At least that's the way I interpret it. We've talked about the importance of priorities. Priority list is simply your do list put in a totem pole of priorities, that's all. So that you're majoring on the majors instead of on the minors. So it simplifies life, and so it gets things done. The do list is pretty important. And particularly to make sure that you're doing the first things first. Here he says, one thing I ask the Lord. So the priority list not only puts the priority on top, but it simplifies life and enables you to concentrate on that which is really important. So easy for us to push our way past the important things, to do the little things and get them out of the way so we can get to the really important things. And somehow or other, life sees to it that we never run out of the little things. It is a bottomless pit. It is an endless list. And we have to make up our minds what we're going to concentrate on. And he said, one thing have I asked of the Lord, that I will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. In Psalm 23, he said, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I have always interpreted that as meaning eternity, forever. He will be with the Lord. But here he's talking about in this life. Dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Now, I think we all know he doesn't mean he's going to live in the temple all that time, but in the presence of the Lord. For two things. First, to behold the beauty of the Lord. And secondly, and to inquire in his temple. We are aware that we are changed by beholding. And as we behold Christ, we become more like him. So to behold the beauty of the Lord, and then to inquire, to find out what he wants me to do, that I might do that. This reminds me of the two questions that Paul, or Saul, asked when the Lord arrested him on the way to Damascus. His first question was what? Who art thou, Lord? And his second question, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? Those are the two questions here. Who art thou, Lord? And then secondly, to inquire in his temple, what do you want me to do? And through the years, I have found it helpful to make those two questions as the basic two questions of every morning's quiet time. Who art thou, Lord? And Lord, what do you want me to do today? Get to know him a little better and know from him specifically what he wants me to do. When Dawson died in 1956, it was another crisis year in the Navigators. Our speaker already lined up for the staff conference that summer, which followed not too many weeks after Dawson's death, was Dr. Carnell of Fuller Theological Seminary. Some of you may remember this. And to me, a highlight message that he brought was on Christian heroes. And in that message he said, and I quote here, the Navigator movement is safe under God as it passes through what I think is a very perilous transition. It is safe under God if the movement is in the hands of heroes. Well, of course, the same can be said of any movement, any church, if at the center there are some Christian heroes. And then, quoting from Thomas Carlyle in an essay, Heroes and Hero Worships, he pointed out that Carlyle said there are three things that mark a hero, a true hero. One, he has penetrated into the meaning of ultimate reality. He has penetrated into the meaning of ultimate reality. He knows where he came from, why he's here, and where he's going. And oftentimes this makes a person like that somewhat mysterious. I asked Doss Trotman one day about this, because there was a sense in which he seemed a little cocksure. And I said to him one day, I said, you know, Doss, you kind of have a certainty about you, a positiveness about you, that makes me think that you think you're kind of a man of destiny. He said, I don't know about that, but he said, I do know that the Lord has spoken to me about some things he wants to do, and I know he's going to do those things. I just know it. The second thing that Carlyle says is a hero not only has penetrated into the meaning of ultimate reality, but secondly, he holds this truth or faith in honesty, sincerity, and humility. That is, he lives by it. This affects his life. It affects his character. It affects what he does. And thirdly, and these three things, one seems to lead into the other, he casts himself upon this ultimate reality without reservation. He acts on it. He'll lay down his life for it. Now, if we take as an illustration the writer of this psalm, and one incident out of his life from 1 Samuel 17, we get a little idea here that in David, we have an authentic hero. You remember that David had been out with the sheep, been home. Now his father sent him out to see how his brothers are doing, and he gets out and he finds this situation where this giant, Goliath, is challenged and is terrifying the Philistine army. Now, we are aware, of course, that killing the giant did not make David a hero. David was already a hero looking for a place to happen. This circumstance didn't make him the hero. It displayed the fact that he already was one. And when you look at his response, you see how that was true. When he came up here and saw what was happening, he asked about it. He said, what's this man doing? And they told him. And here was what he said. What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? That was his concern. His first thought was of God. Now, Isaiah 51 says, who art thou that thou should be afraid of a man that shall die? And it goes on to say, 51:13, and forgettest the Lord thy maker. Fear of man comes as a result of fear of forgetting God. Now, a hero has penetrated through to ultimate reality. He knows God. And this pops out. That was his immediate response. Who is this to defy the armies of the living God? And you go on a little farther. And he said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. You go on a little farther. That all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. This was his great concern, was God. He naturally, immediately, almost without thought, related God to that situation. Now, I don't know how it is with you, but I know how it is with me. A problem comes up and I wrestle with it, think about it, put down the pros and cons, talk to people about it. And finally, somewhere down the line, I remember to bring God into the picture. But a real, authentic Christian hero is someone who brings God in the picture right now. It's just second nature. I think it is someone who has made first in their lives, one thing have I desired of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord, and to inquire in his temple. And of course, ultimate reality is God. Let not the Chinese glory in his wisdom, let not the Russian glory in his might, let not the American glory in his riches, but let him that glories glory in this, that he understands and knows me. A little loose translation of Jeremiah 9:23-24. And that's God himself, not just his gifts. God himself, not just his reasons, not just his guidance, not just the things that come out from it, but God. I think of another authentic hero is Joseph. And just let me call your attention to a couple things here. Here's a man who had penetrated through to ultimate reality. When Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him to sin with her, he said, "How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" That's the first thing that popped into his mind. When he was in prison and the butler and the baker had the dreams, and they said to him, "We have had dreams and there's no one to interpret them." Here in prison, the first thing that Joseph thought of to say was, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, I pray you." Later on, when the word got to Pharaoh that this fellow Joseph could help him, and he called Joseph in front of him, Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer." Later on, when he got married, Pharaoh gave him a wife, he had the sons. The first one he called Manasseh, for he said, "God has made me forget." The next one he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful. There was someone hooked into God. As David was. And Dr. Carnell, quoting Carlyle, said, "And the man holds this in sincerity, honesty, and humility." Honest is the fact. That's so important, to be honest with God and to be honest with one another. Or we can start through life living a sham. It's so easy. We've been around long enough to use the right language, to say the right things at the right time. But for this not to be genuine, weighed down. I still remember the day at West Point when I was asking some of the fellows in a small group of when they got time for the quiet time. And this one young fellow, as I came around to him, he said to me, "I don't have a quiet time, sir." Man, I like that. Because what does the average person say? "Well, I try thus and so. Or I plan so and so." Said, "All right, I don't have a quiet time, sir." We've got to be honest and sincere as to motive and humble in attitude. You know, when David went out to fight Goliath, I imagine his brothers were embarrassed to tears. "Oh, no. Look at him. out there with a shepherd's bag. No armor, no sword, no spear, and a sling. Why did he ever stay home? Oh, how mortifying.
David just went out there, and he had a chance to use Saul's armor, but, you know, to look right. But he said, you know, it didn't fit me. That's not my thing. And he spent a lot of hours, I bet you, with that sling. So he did his thing, all right. But you know, when they got after him for this, his response was humble. There's humility. Yeah. And then he said that a hero will commit himself unreservedly. David said, why does any man's heart fail because of this man? I will fight him. I'll get in the battle. Well, there are a couple authentic heroes, David, Joseph. I think of another one. I may have mentioned to some of you that for the last couple of years, I've been working on a little Sani theology. What do I believe and why? My mind sort of works in those directions. And I've just started a little notebook. What do I really believe and why do I believe it? And I've spent quite a bit of time on it. But all the time I was working on it, I felt like there was something missing. In fact, there was some whole area missing in what I was doing that it bothered me, it bugged me, irritated me. I knew it was there, but I couldn't put my finger on what it was. There was some major area that I was missing. And then I had a book recommended to me, which I'd recommend to you for your reading sometime. I didn't know that Oswald Chambers had a book on Job. And it's called Baffled to Fight Better. And because there's so many of us, I like to have everything, all the answers and everything neat, tidied up, little package, and there's the answer. It's neat and clear. But the more I work in my own theology, the more I see that things don't tie up. There's always something squirting out over here and popping out over there. It won't just fit in like you want it to. And then Oswald Chambers pointed out about Job. That Job, here he was, and God and Satan agreed to make his soul a battleground. Not only without Job's consent, but without his knowledge. And even as you read God's answer to him in the end of the book of Job, I don't can't even include that he ever did tell him in this life what happened. So Job's three friends came. Now these were smart fellows. They had answers. They knew what they believed and why. This is what I've been working on all this while. What I believed and why. Well, these guys knew what they believed and why. It was very simple. If you are righteous, you prosper. If you're a sinner, you don't prosper. Job is not prospering, therefore he's a sinner. Simple. Cut, dried, easy, wrapped up in the package, all decided. Now, Job couldn't answer. He said, well, that isn't it. But neither could he say what it was. He didn't know what or why, really. Then as I meditated on that, something dawned on me that was this whole missing area that I knew was there and I couldn't put my finger on it. It was simply this. These fellows knew what they believed and why, but Job knew whom he believed. And that's far better than knowing what you believe and why. And therefore, Paul said in 2 Peter 1, or 2 Timothy 1, for I know whom I have believed. Now that is breaking through to ultimate reality. That, I think, is basic. And therefore, we come back to Psalm 27:4. One thing have I desired of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. Therefore, I like to remind all of us, and myself included, because one of the best ways I find to get through to others is to preach to me. And since most of us have our needs about the same, it usually comes across then. To make sure that we don't begin to squeeze down those quiet places in our lives. In fact, to extend them a bit. Not only that quiet time, and not only that word of prayer with our mate before we go to sleep at night, but also those occasional half days or days out in a park somewhere or on a beach or up in the side of a hill under a tree, the extended times with God. I can still take you around Glen Eyrie and show you, I imagine two or three or four places right now, where Doss liked to go outside and had the rocks sort of rearranged there so he could sit a little more comfortably for extended times with God. I think that's what breaks through to ultimate reality. That's what hooks us in with eternity. And therefore affects and is a good infection to every other part of our lives. So all I'm pleading for and reminding ourselves of as we go back, let's keep first things first. And as for me, I'd like to plan a few more extensive, quiet spaces in life. And I know somehow or other I like them better out in the open, a little closer to nature. Behold the beauty of the Lord, and to inquire in his temple. Who art thou, Lord? And Lord, what do you want me to do? Now let's pray, shall we?